Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Tried Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective. Due to the sensitive nature of today's topic, discretion is advised for younger listeners.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and I'm joined today by Dr. Teresa Albizu. Teresa is the founder and co-president of the RA Pinnacle Group, an organizational behavior and leadership development consulting firm. Teresa also served as a higher education leader for over 20 years, held a faculty appointment, teaching courses in marriage and family therapy, and maintained a private mental health practice focusing on relationship issues. Currently, Teresa is the chief executive officer of Safe Space, a domestic violence agency in the Florida Treasure Cove. She is also a member of the adjunct faculty at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. Teresa, my friend, welcome to Behavioral Health Today.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you for inviting me to be with you today.
So nice to have you. Today, our topic is discussing the silent domestic violence pandemic. Teresa, let's start with the title of our talk today, the silent domestic violence pandemic. We're going to be defining domestic violence in just a moment, but why do you refer to this as a pandemic as being silent?
Well, Graham, the reality is that domestic violence has been a global pandemic long before the COVID-19 outbreak.
That's right.
Across the years, there have been millions of individuals who have been affected by domestic violence incidents. In all reality, United Nations reports that 243 million women and girls between the ages of 15 and 49 worldwide have been subjected to sexual or physical violence by an intimate partner. But this is historically a taboo subject. People just do not want to talk about domestic violence. And in many cases, a lot of people even have some difficulty identifying that they may, in fact, be in a situation of domestic abuse.
I'd like to come back and talk about what makes it so difficult to define it, but let's start by setting a framework of having you define it for us. What is domestic violence and how do you define it in a working way?
So the definition of domestic violence is a pattern of abusive behavior in any relationship that is used by one partner to gain or maintain control over another intimate partner. Yeah. So really, within the context of the relationship, abuse is about power and control, one partner over the other, right? And correct. I think that it's important that we understand that there are many different types of abuse because domestic violence is typically associated with physical abuse, right?
Yes.
And which becomes more obvious to identify, right? The black eye, the marks in the body, the sprained wrists, even signs of choking on the neck. But there's domestic abuse includes sexual abuse, right? So that occurs when an abuser coerces or attempts to force a victim into having sexual contact without the victim's consent.
Yes.
And then we also have emotional abuse, which is characterized by deflating an individual's sense of self-worth or self-esteem. Yes. So that looks like constant criticism or name calling or even injuring a victim's relationship with their children.
Yes.
So that's important to recognize. Economic abuse is something that is not typically identified as domestic violence, but it is because it takes place when the abuser makes or tries to make the victim financially reliant. So they want to take total control of the financial resources of the household. They withhold victims access to funds, or sometimes they even prohibit a victim from going to school or work so that they cannot earn any money or gain skills that enables them to seek gainful employment. And then there's also psychological abuse, right? So that is invoking a great deal of fear on the victim through intimidation and threats. Threats of taking the children away from them or destruction of property or injuring pets, right? And of course, isolating the victim from loved ones is a real highlight of psychological abuse. in domestic violence incidents. So all those things, right, comprise domestic abuse, and stalking and cyber stalking, I may add, are included in the definition of domestic violence.
I still appreciate the kind of very well-rounded explanation of what comprises domestic abuse. We typically might hear somebody say, well, he doesn't hit me. Mm-hmm. And this can happen to men too. They can be on the receiving end of this, but more majority is women. Perpetrators are men. And we'll hear, well, he doesn't hit me, so it can't be abuse, right? I don't have a black eye, I don't have marks, I haven't got a broken arm, I haven't gone to the ER, et cetera. But all these other components of domestic abuse can be far more subtle, insidious as they're employed in the working relationship. In fact, as perplexing as it might sound, and I love your take on this, those in domestic violent relationships don't always recognize that they're actually in a relationship that's driven by the power and control that you're describing over them. In addition, domestic violence covers those from all walks of life. It doesn't discriminate on the basis of intelligence, on one's success, one's wealth. It covers the full spectrum of race and ethnicity. What have you found that makes it difficult for someone in an abusive, controlled, and like you said, power-driven relationship to recognize what they're actually living in? What makes it so hard?
Well, to begin with, unfortunately, domestic violence and engaging in the process of participating in an abusive relationship, it's a learned behavior.
Yes.
So we know that when children witness domestic violence in the household, those children tend to learn maladaptive ways of managing relationships as they grow up.
Yes.
But the other side also occurs, right? Which is that in this case, women, because they're the majority of the victims of domestic abuse, women also learn how to be submissive in a relationship and not speak up and assert, right, their rights or their preferences, or be able to talk about how they feel the relationship should be demonstrated, how love is expressed, how affection is expressed, how respect is considered in the relationship. They learn to be very quiet and just assume that. And in fact, just last month, Graham, we had a victim of domestic violence enter our shelter in the Treasure Coast. And very quickly, we realized that this woman had been in our shelter 15 years prior as a child with her own mother.
Is that right?
Yeah. So it is learned behavior, not only on the aggressor's part, but it also can impact the ability of individuals to really take action and assert, you know, their, let's call it authority or ability, right, to be able to move away and exit a situation of domestic abuse.
I think unless we understand what you're saying right now, it's so easy to judge. Well, why don't you just leave?
Right.
Why do you let someone treat you that way? Or why do you go back? And so we become blaming of, but we don't understand the whole syndrome related to what you're describing. And what you're describing at another layer is very important. Basically, we do what we know, what we're raised in, and how we adapt is very adaptive. It keeps us alive. It keeps us safe. There are defensive strategies, there are relational strategies, and it works in our family. And then if we're doing what we know, we're going to find people like this in our lives unknowingly, unintentionally, because we know the language, we know the behavior, we know how to be, and we begin to perpetuate this in kind of a multi-generational way, don't we?
Yes. And if you think about it, social isolation is one of the most common tactics employed by perpetrators of intimate partner violence.
Why
is
that?
By isolating victims from friends, family, and any outside contact, abusers are able to assert control over the victim's entire environment.
Yeah.
So this social isolation actually can lead to the normalization of abuse, right? This is what I know. This is what my life is like. These are the conditions in which I live in. It's kind of like those individuals who normalize stress, right? And they don't know how to recognize when they're entering into a process of chronic, long-standing stress. Same thing in domestic violence. Persistent isolation really can cause victims to rely solely on their abusers to define a sense of reality.
And what's so subtle about that, let's kind of paint a quick picture. Someone comes out of a family with abuse. That's what they've seen, witnessed. That becomes their schemata from which they do their own world with and understand how the world works. And they're going to find people in their lives that are going to replicate what they know, you know, the repetition compulsion. We're compelled to repeat those patterns of behavior that we're familiar with. Exactly. So this idea that we don't even know what we're doing sometimes, we don't know what we're getting into. And the curious piece is that a lot of women coming out of domestic violent families will find a man who at the very beginning is saying, hey, baby, I love you and I can't be without you. I so miss you. Could you not go to the Friday night after hours drinks with your friends? Can you just come home and let's just hang out together? And that feels loving. That feels caring. That feels compassionate. Yeah. But what you're indicating to us is that's the beginning of control.
Yes.
What feels passionate in an expression, what feels, you know, want to hold tight and those kinds of things, what feels bad, that's really power.
And we have to recognize also how pervasive this problem is. If you think about it in terms of numbers, an average of 24 people per minute are victims of rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in the United States. That's more than 20 million women and men over the course of a single year, 12 million. Yeah. That's really, really a staggering number. And a lot of people don't recognize how pervasive this problem is. And if we want to put it in another way, over 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men in the United States have experienced rape, physical violence, and are stalking by an intimate partner in their life. 1 in 3 women. So if you're in a gathering and there are 10 people, a third of the women there have probably experienced some sort of intimate partner violence in their lifetime.
Yeah, so you're talking about the silent part of this pandemic. We don't know how to talk about it. We may not know how to recognize it. And around that too, as you're talking about it, there's all kinds of guilt and shame and fear. What if I talk about this? What's gonna happen?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of layers to this. You know, within the context of what we're in right now with COVID, we're mandated to stay inside. We're mandated to kind of even isolate more from each other and huddle up within our homes. What have you seen in terms of an increase in the number of folks going through the domestic violence with this time?
So we work very closely with law enforcement, right? Most domestic violence centers do. And so what we saw in Florida, an average of 20% increase in the incidence of domestic violence incidents during the months of March, April, May, June.
Wow.
That's a huge increase.
Oh, yeah.
And when we looked at the statistics worldwide, the United Nations Population Fund reports the same level of increase, about 20% rise in intimate partner violence throughout the world. So in total, the report predicts that at least 15 million additional cases of domestic abuse have occurred during the COVID-19 lockdown.
That is huge. 50 million people.
It is huge. It is very huge. And then the other thing that we need to keep in mind is that domestic violence goes significantly underreported. Yes, so these percentages are based on individuals who initiate a report, right? So actually the increase in incidents is likely to be quite higher. Right.
You said earlier 1 in 3. I would imagine it's 2 in 3. And every woman has gone through something to some degree on a continuum of that power and control, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I'd love to learn a little bit more about your work with Safe Space and what you're doing to address this rise in domestic violence and just the ongoing care and treatment you're providing people that come in your doors.
Well, I have to tell you that as I began this work a few months back, I felt a strong affinity immediately with the mission of this agency. I am glad to say that I work on the board of the Florida Partnership to End Domestic Violence, which provides services and guidance to 42 domestic violence centers in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. And we work very hard to ensure that access is always available to victims when they need us. So we have a 24-hour hotline that is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to provide individuals with crisis intervention and counseling, support, information, referrals, and of course, lethality assessment, because that's another area that goes highly underreported, which is in particular the women who are at risk of being murdered by their aggressor.
Yeah.
So that is an important part of what we do, right? Ensure that people can call us and we will help them to get out of a very difficult situation very quickly, and then bring them over to our shelter if they so need it. Not everybody needs shelter, because some individuals have family, friends that are willing to provide them with support. But for those that don't have that readily available, or their friends and families are outside of their catchment area, we have a shelter that provides survivors with food, clothing, counseling, education, support, and of course, advocacy. And that's where our outreach advocate services come in. And I want everybody to understand that domestic violence centers are much more than just a shelter, a wide array of outreach advocate services to help individuals with safety and action planning, lethality assessment, relocation assistance, counseling, legal assistance, linkage to community resources, job assistance, medical and therapeutic assistance. So it's a gamut of everything that an individual may need to be able to smoothly as possible transition into an independent life free of violence.
I think that's so important. You know, we can say, you know, I've heard the narrative, well, I'm going to leave for the weekend, but I've got to go back on Monday. Or, you know, I'm going to be a single mom with two children. I don't have a job anymore, because that was part of the control and power.
Right.
Taught to rely and depend upon him as an invitation. And now I'm dependent in such a way that I can't get out. And what am I going to do? I have no place to go. So you're talking about these programs, or the one you're working with, the Safe Space. It's a full continuum, isn't
it? Yes, it's a full continuum.
Services that someone's going to need. And it sounds like you're going to walk them through in an assured way that we're going to get through this together. And let's walk you through all the different levels and components of maintaining some, not just safety, but getting some independence and getting yourself back.
That's right. And the important part of this work is that we try to stay in touch and available with our program participants for as long as they want to, right? So some individuals stay in our outreach programs through a few months to a year. Others are multi-year. So an example of that would be an individual who transitioned into independent living, but then require further assistance, you know, with food bank or food stamps or any other social services program. We recently had a participant who came in with the kids who were in middle school, stay in touch with Safe Space after they completed several of our programs, and then came back because now their child was ready to access higher education. And
really
they needed help. I'm figuring out how, as a single parent, do we make this opportunity available to our children? How do we examine what are the college opportunities? How do we pay for this? You know, how is it that we can make this a reality to our children? And our advocates are really there to provide that support as well.
Boy, you're really changing, aren't you, in a situation like that, this generational legacy.
Yes.
They get to write a different chapter in their lives now that's maybe been written for them or they've been a part of prior to coming in to receive your services. And their children get to benefit from not having to know that life or being caught up in it. So if we have a listener that suspects maybe a friend or a family member may be a victim of domestic abuse, domestic violence, what are some of the warning signs that they might see that could be very subtle from the outside looking in? What might they see and how might they identify it? And then maybe what could they do to maybe begin to raise a discussion with the person they're concerned about?
So subtle signs typically come from emotional signs, right? Like when you see people that are unusually agitated or anxious, people who are behaving or expressing constant apprehension, changes in sleep habits, whether it's sleeping too much or not enough. When we witness individuals developing a drug or alcohol problem, even individuals when they become extremely apologetic or meek, you know, you start questioning, where is this coming from? Low self-esteem, seeming fearful, right? And sometimes, you know, when they start talking about suicide or even, you know, attempting suicide. And I think that it's important that we reach out and we recognize these symptoms, right? including some behavioral, some changes in behavior, because some of these individuals also become reserved and distant.
Yep.
They want to reserve to themselves. They're figuring out how they come out of this very difficult situation in their life. And you were right, Graham, when you mentioned there's a big sense of feelings of guilt and shame, right? Yeah. That I found myself in this situation and that I haven't been able to do anything about it. Yeah. And that only supports the victim's state of helplessness, of sense of helplessness, right? Because these aggressors, these abusers really take full power and control over the victim's lives. And then these individuals suddenly just don't know exactly how to make the decisions that they need to move from the abusive relationship. So I think when we observe these things, please don't look away and don't think, oh, they're just having a relationship issue or a marital problem. These things merit that we have a nice conversation, right? In a subtle manner, asking them how they're feeling. If there's something that is worrying them that we can help them with. It's okay to say, I see you. You look a bit sad and anxious, and I'm concerned about you because I care about you. Can you tell me what's going on? How can I help you? And extend a hand, a helping hand. I am glad that I have been seeing a lot of employers actually intervening in situations when they see individuals that may be experiencing domestic violence and actually encouraging, because that's all we can do. We cannot force these individuals to go to law enforcement. We cannot force them to come to our domestic violence center, but we need to encourage them and recommend that they take some sort of action and tell them, I'll go with you. In what way can I support you so that you can begin this process, so that they start feeling that they begin to take back a sense of control in their life, some decision making that will lead them into a more joyful and fulfilled life.
What I love about your encouragement in that is that sometimes we just have to have the courage to say, are you doing okay? Or to just kind of breach what feels to be maybe unspeakable, or maybe we should just stay silent, hence the silent pandemic.
Yes.
And rather than kind of collude with that silence, you're saying, just breach it. Just say something. It's almost like we're afraid that if we say something, we're going to set something off. Or it's almost like, you know, if we talk to our kids about sex, they're going to go have sex. We talk about drugs, they're going to go use drugs. So if we address this, you know, the potential for, is there domestic violence going on? We're going to set something in motion. No, we're not. We're going to come alongside somebody. We're going to name that it's okay to talk about it. And we're going to provide a safe space that they get to fill in a way that's comfortable for them, that's non-judgmental, non-shaming, non-guilt producing, but just inviting to say, are you okay? So I love that you're crafting the language for us too about how to enter in and just say, hey, I'm concerned. Here's what I'm observing. Can I be of help?
Yes. And we need to speak up and make the intervention, Graham. Yes. The more that we remain silent about domestic violence, that's what domestic violence will remain, a silent issue.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
And we're not going to be able to make the strides that we need to make at all levels, right? At the judicial level, in our social services level, in the employment settings, to be able to address this very unfortunate high incidence of abuse that we are experiencing in this country.
In addition to helping us understand how to approach, what are some resources that you might recommend for us that would be really accessible for those that maybe are going to talk to somebody, or for us to further understand this? Resources that you'd recommend to us?
Well, I think that an important resource is the National Domestic Violence Hotline. It's 1-800-799-7233. So it's important that if you yourself are witnessing some signs, you can even go here and seek support in how to address the issue with someone else.
Yes.
In addition, that they have an incredibly wonderful number of resources for the victims themselves that they can start accessing. In Florida here, we're very proud of the work that we do. So Safe Space of Florida, we have our own hotline, and that hotline is 772-288-7233. So we are here 24/7 to help individuals. And remember that we all have a responsibility to take calls from whomever and wherever they are. Yes. And if they're not in our catchment area, we're going to refer them to the right place, and we'll give mm-hmm. them the information and the contact information to be able to seek the help that they need.
Really good. Well, Teresa, I so appreciate you being with us today and helping us further understand not just domestic abuse, but what it looks like, what we can do, how we can come alongside people during this time, what they're going through, the signs and the symptoms of these things that can be very subtle, but to put a different light on it, to understand it for what it really is, and that there are ways to work through this. Women, let's just say, and men that go through this too, they can reclaim their lives.
Yes, they can.
And they can begin to live the life that they've been designed and created to live, finally.
Yes,
getting out of this, you know, syndrome that they've been involved with, maybe not even knowing what they didn't know about being in it at the very beginning, born into it possibly, but being able to change this generational legacy in a very hopeful way with places like Safe Space, your work. So thank you so much for what you've shared with us today and left our listeners with.
Thank you, Graham. All I want to say is, if you're listening, you are not alone. We're here to help you. Please reach out.
Please do. That's awesome. And to our listeners, we do appreciate you as well. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.